Welkom bij deze podcast van 360. Vandaag spreek ik met Lucy Koek, bioloog, programmamaker en auteur, van wie ik het grote genoeg heb gehad om samen met Nadia Ramer haar boek Wilde Verhalen te vertalen, waarin ze een mythe over dieren ontkracht en de bizarre manieren waarop wetenschappers, die vaak niet werden geloofd, de waarheid achterhaalden. In haar nieuwe boek, Bitch, al vertaald in 11 talen, hanteert ze grotendeels dezelfde aanpak, maar richt zich op vrouwen en de vele aannames rond geslacht en gender, ook weer in het dierenrijk. Ze praat niet graag over mensen, want dat is niet haar comfortzone, zoals ze me vertelt. Ik ontmoet haar op een zaterdagochtend in het Ambassadehotel op de Herengracht in Amsterdam.
When I was translating this, I told everybody that, that I wanted to be your friend as well, because I thought it's so nice.
Aww.
It's scary for you.
No, you nice seem very tell. Nice. I'd be very happy to be your friend. Yeah. I like your sweatshirt. So we're, you
yeah,
know.
We're so good.
Yeah.
No, and I also told everybody that I wanted to have your job because it sounds so fantastic. Mm. So I was wondering, is your job as fantastic as it sounds in your books?
Oh, well, that's, yes, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you read about the fantastic bits.
Yeah.
So the bits where I'm off traveling and having adventures, that's the highlight. That's why I do what I do, because I love to have adventures, to go to places, to meet with scientists, to be in the field, to see animals in the wild is what I live for.
Yeah.
But then the writing about those things takes longer than the adventure does. So the adventure maybe is like a week, you know, and the writing about the adventures takes a very long time. So my job, that bit of my job is very difficult, you know, requires a lot of self-discipline and saying no to having fun with my friends because I have to stay at home and write, you know. So but I feel very lucky. I have managed to secure a career that is my passion. You know, I mean, I earn money doing things that I would pay money to do. I feel like it's a huge privilege. And I often, even being here in Amsterdam with you today, I mean, I love Amsterdam.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic city.
Yeah.
I'm staying in an amazing hotel, you know.
Yeah.
And I have to pinch myself that I'm able to do these things. You know, I feel very lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you tell in your books that it has to do, the choice of your profession has to do with your father as well.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up on the farm.
Yes. Yeah, so I've always been transfixed by the natural world. My dad was an old fashioned countryman. You know, his father was a shepherd and he was just one of those people who he knew everything about the countryside that he grew up in. You know, he'd step out of the front door and, you know, touch the hedge and look at the weather and go, the seasons are coming out this year. You know, he was really one of those people. And we were very close. And my favorite memories as a child were going off into the woods with him, looking for birds' nests. He was a very keen ornithologist.
Okay.
And so we used to go looking for birds' nests together. And then he sunk an old Victorian bathtub in the garden and I made a pond out of it. And so we used to go to collect pond water every weekend and look for frogs and tadpoles and you know, all sorts of strange water beetles. And that really sort of, because I was effectively an only child, so that was like my Narnia, you know. It was like I'd disappear into this watery kingdom and I was obsessed with ponds, just obsessed.
Yeah.
You know, and all the weird, wonderful creatures that inhabit this underwater world. And they seem so alien and so fascinating. So that was really where my love of the natural world was born. It's in my blood. You know, I can't... I suppose we're all as adults trying to recreate our childhood, happy childhood memories in some way. So I think I'm doing that every time I go and have an adventure.
Yeah.
Looking for chimpanzees or whatever it is, it takes me back to that happy place as a child, I think.
Yeah. Mm. And are you still fond of ponds?
I still am really fond of ponds. and frogs are still my favourite animal.
Let's not forget.
And so nothing has changed there.
Okay. Mm. That's because you can, maybe the pond can be like a metaphor for the whole universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think
absolutely,
that's,
yeah.
Yeah. Also, when you... a friend of mine, she bought like a small garden in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And since then, she says, I'm all talking in clichés because all the things that happen in the garden are like a huge metaphor for things in the world. So yeah, you just have to be patient because, you know, the plant will do its work or things like that. I think that's maybe that's also an attractive thing about nature.
And absolutely. Maybe,
again, I can really picture it in you and a little pond, and then it's so small, but it's everything.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It was only small, but it was a whole world and another world and an alien world because it was underwater.
Yeah.
You know, so exactly. It demanded to be explored.
Yeah,
and the creatures that lived in it were very, very different to me. Lived their lives very differently, but then they were all connected. And I was obsessed with frogs. Even then, but then they're like at the top of the food chain. You know, I knew I had to get all the other elements underneath, you know, all the microorganisms that the bugs could eat those so that there were enough bugs for the frogs to eat the bugs, you know. So I was sort of that whole universe was very important to me.
Yeah.
And fascinating. And I think that's why, you know, I'm, you know, a huge fan of biodiversity and strange weird creatures, and I'm fascinated by the interconnectedness of it all, you know.
And how evolution,
yes, exactly, yeah,
made it all up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so what I really like about your work, both books, is the way you bring up new perspectives to look at, I think, like, accepted truths, but they don't seem to be true at all. Mm-hmm. And it's totally different and totally weird. But then it's not weird because it's only weird because we thought it was the other way around or because we focus on human beings. Do you think, because it's, of course, this one is a lot about past. Well, this one. Do you think there's still now a lot of accepted truths that are not, that will not, like, in 100 years, will you be able to write a book about this time with all these?
That's a really good question. Yeah, it's a really good question. And you'd really hope not, right?
Well, I like your book. So.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, but it's amazing how sticky these myths are.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, I mean, if you think about the first book, you know, some of those myths that I wrote about, like elephants are afraid of mice, for example, you know, that was written in the bestiaries in the Middle Ages. You know, I mean, and you know, that's a very sort of random example, but you know, it's fascinating to me how we just persist in seeing our reflection in the animal kingdom, and we're almost incapable of doing otherwise. But just projecting onto them something that we have invented about ourselves as well in many cases. So and in the case of Bitch, obviously I'm looking specifically at how sexist bias has shaped our understanding of female animals. And you know, I would really hope that I'm not able to write that book in 100 years I don't know, you know, I just don't know, because it you know, although huge progress is being made, and we are in the throes of a paradigm shift at the moment in terms of evolutionary biology and how it's taught. It's taken an awful long time to get here. I mean, the pioneers in this field who started addressing these tired stereotypes, they are now in their 80s. They're these amazing women that I met who started researching females and discovering the truth about how females are promiscuous and competitive and aggressive, just like males, back in the 1980s. You know, that's 40 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
How much and yet it's still it's not common knowledge, you know, and it's still, some of that is still being resisted by the scientific community, depending on where you are. So it's... Who knows whether how long these are. I feel like these patriarchal stereotypes are very persistent.
Yeah. In your book, you describe many female biologists and so on who are concerned with finding out the facts about women in the animal kingdom rather than the myths. But you also describe that there are a few men. Is that group of men growing?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm very keen to point out in the book that you don't need to be a man to be a feminist.
No, exactly. Yeah.
At all. That's, you know, I mean, Franz Duval, for example, who's, you know, he's, I mean, me too. I interviewed him for this book.
Okay.
And for my next book, I've the one that I'm working on at the moment, he's in there as well, because he's such an enlightened scientist, and he's done so much for, you know, challenging preconceived ideas and putting forward new perspectives.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he'd call himself a feminist, you know. And he's quite old now, you know, so he's of an older generation that was also pioneering. So yes, there's plenty of people of all genders who are interested in, I think now maybe people are, you know, I'm excited at the moment because the sort of new wave of scientists who, you know, younger generation are, I think, less focused on binary stereotypes.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, in the next 10, 20 years, we'll see some amazing new discoveries that understand the kind of fluidity and the plasticity of sex and its expression.
Yeah, 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 that's true. That's a whole different generation.
Mm.
And I was also wondering, because Franz de Waal, I think in his book, The Unders, how is it called? Different?
Different, yes, I read it. It's wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, mm. Very. Because now there's also a big group of people saying that, well, gender doesn't exist, or gender, we're all exactly the same. But in fact, he points out in his book that there are big differences between, well, human men and women. Is that also what you read? Not the stereotypes, but the, well...
Of course, he focuses mainly on primates.
But then he says you can really, there's something like a monkey that will... A female monkey that will play with a doll. That's a stereotype. But do you also, did you also read it?
I do you know, I don't know that research. So I have to say that was the only bit of his book that I wondered about.
Yeah.
Actually, I know that Carl Zimmer wrote a critique of that in the New York Times.
Oh, okay.
So Carl Zimmer is a famous evolutionary geneticist.
Yeah.
But I don't know the papers myself, so I can't comment. But I would like to look more into that for this new book that I'm working on. But I don't know.
No, okay.
Because I mean, I think that there's a lot of from my research, I think that a lot of human gender stereotypes are cultural rather than biological.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much, I don't feel comfortable talking about humans. It's not my specialist area. Whereas Franz de Waal, you know, he's done more work with primates and anthropology.
Yeah,
so he may well be right. Am I not going to be like criticize the great Franz de Waal? But I did wonder, and I know that there has been some criticism of that in his book. So I don't know.
I'm going to read that. So in the animal world, there is no gender at all, right?
Well, I mean, there may well be, but it's very hard to ascertain because you can't ask gender is a social psychological construct, you know. So it may well be, as Franz says, that chimpanzees have gender and other fish have gender, but it's just very hard to discern because you can't ask a fish what sex it is, you know, can only divine it by observing them, and we're still trying to observe very basic things, so it's impossible to work out, you know. So it's easier to say that they don't have gender, but it is possible that that there is something akin to gender in more intelligent social animals, but it's just how you work that out. I don't know.
Okay.
In your book, you give many examples of stories that turn out to be very different from what was always assumed. For example, that all mothers are protective of their children, or that women are passive in sex. Do you also come across many stereotype confirming stories?
Well, I mean, obviously what I'm trying to do with this book is I'm just trying to present another perspective.
Yeah.
But I'm not trying to say that all the animal kingdom, all females are dominant and aggressive. And, you know, there are plenty of females that do conform to stereotypes and, you know, where males will be more aggressive and competitive than females. Although I say that, but actually, you know, increasingly most females are being found to... mate promiscuously and to be competitive. So, but of course there are females that conform to stereotypes, but I just didn't see the need to write. I mean, I couldn't write about every single animal in my book. Do you know what I mean? So I just chose to write about to illustrate what we hadn't understood before.
And so your style, the alliterations and the word jokes, and is it something that comes very natural when you write? Because it's like a bizarre world, or
I've always told stories. That's what I am. I've always been a storyteller.
Yeah,
I mean, since I was little, I can remember just telling stories and trying to make people laugh. So I've always been, you know, enjoyed making people laugh, and the stories that I like telling are truthful. You know, I like telling stories about the real world, about real things, factual things. And I like telling those stories with humor because, you know, I'm interested in telling popular stories. I want to write rigorously scientific work that is read by a very wide audience, and people who wouldn't normally pick up a science book. Would read my books.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, Bitch is actually is a dense scientific work, actually, but it's in disguise. And the humor and my putting myself in the story disguises the sort of the serious nature of the book, basically.
Oh, that's also very smart.
I mean, it is smart, but it's also I can't do it any other way.
No,
like I'm terrible. I will go for the joke always.
Then
my literary agent, he reads everything first, and he takes out half the jokes. And then I put half of them back in again.
Yeah.
So, but he's absolutely right. And that, you know, you can't, sometimes the jokes don't age well.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's funny with the, because I don't know, you've read both books, but the first book's a lot funnier than the second book, I think. The first book is very funny. Most people think, I think the first book's very funny. And I deliberately told stories that are, you know, I mean, like the man who goes to the Arctic to study the penguins is completely charmed by them and then discovers that they're pathologically unpleasant necrophiliacs, you know, and he's completely horrified by it. You know, I mean, it's a very funny story, you know.
Yeah.
And so I chose to write that story because, A, I enjoy it because it's showing how silly we are to project ourselves and ideas onto animals.
Yeah.
But it's in a very funny way, right?
Yeah.
But when it came to writing Bitch, we had a discussion, my editor and my literary agent and I, and we all agreed that I should have less jokes in
this.
Yeah,
it's more
because it would just it doesn't help to be too giddy, you know, with it. So
maybe it would distract from because you also have a clearer or more clear message.
Yeah, it's a bit more and the intention is a bit more serious and a bit more urgent with this book. So, so I felt like because I'm used to writing things that are, I like things that are really funny, right? So, and I wrote this and I thought, oh, it's very dry. It's not as funny, you know. But I was so amazed when people come back and they tell me, oh, I was laughing out loud on every page. And you think, really? Wow. Like, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, no, now that you mentioned it, there is a difference because these are more funny stories and these are, it's funny because also because of the way you describe it and because it's so bizarre, some things of nature. But the facts in themselves maybe are less funny.
Yeah.
Although there are very, I can't think of one, but you always have these nice wordplay, the climaxes in your book that works up to something and it's like, whoa. These are, I think people always laugh at.
Thank you.
Okay, so it comes in a natural way. And what's your next book about?
Masculinity.
Nice.
So I felt that, you know, while I was researching this, I wrote, Bitch is also is about males as well, you know, because you can't write about females without writing about males, you know, so it does show a different side of masculinity. But there was a lot more. I found other really good stories, but I couldn't include them because they were about males. And I wanted the focus of this book to be about females. So I had this kind of cache of good stories. And then I also thought it would be good to do a companion piece that was about masculinity so that I'd covered it all, you know?
Yeah.
And because I there's a lot of discussion about masculinity at the moment and what it means to be male.
Yeah.
And you know, I get really angry because I feel like males are being victimized by patriarchal stereotypes as much as females. You know, it's this idea that's going around that all males are meant to be aggressive and dominant, and, you know, it's just as destructive. It damages women, but it damages men too, you know. And a lot of the very popular, you know, podcast bro scientists, you know, they love to use pop science to justify their opinions. And a lot of those pop science studies are based, come from animal studies, and they're often statistically incoherent, or they're just small studies, or, you know, I mean, it's not so difficult to get something published academically. You know, there's lots of journals, and some journals are better than others, but nobody knows that, you know. So I feel like there's a lot of bad science out there about masculinity.
So
the new book is going to be called Cock and Bull, The Great Masculinity Myth. Because, I mean, cock and bull is British for, it's a slang term for rubbish. Obviously a cock and a bull are both masculine. Wow. But in America, it's called half cocked.
Okay.
So, which you probably understand half cocked is. So it's only half the story.
Okay. No, I didn't know the expression. Okay. Yeah.
So obviously that those titles are not going to work here.
No,
we need to find a new one. I was with my Dutch publisher yesterday. They were like, I could see them thinking, what to call it? We've got to think of a new title.
So, but are you nearly finished? Or
oh my God, no. I wish I was. No, I've written about 2 chapters and I've got about another 8 to go. But I did. I am doing one of the story. I'm not. I won't tell the story now because I'll blow it. But I have been including quite a lot of Dutch scientists, so that's
okay. Nice. Okay.
Yeah,
still a surprise.
Yeah,
okay.
Not just Frans de Waal, but other ones.
I was thinking about what you say that you're not comfortable about talking about human beings, but or human species. But in fact, your books are a lot also about human. But it's, of course, it's indirectly.
Yeah.
But so you don't make statements or
I do speak about humans when I feel confident to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I make comparisons when I feel really confident that the information that I have is really good. But you know, I've been very critical, and I continue to be critical of sort of lazy evolutionary psychology that, you know, makes comparisons with humans and lobsters, for example, like Jordan Peterson did. You know, I mean, it's very it was a brilliant, I can't remember the name of the anthropologist who described humans as biocultural ex-apes. Yeah, so biocultural. So it's this, you know, our culture is part of our biology. You know, we are unique in that way that we have this huge influence of culture over our biology, and that changes us, and it makes us really complicated. So making simple inferences from even other primates to humans, you've got to tread very carefully. So that's why I get nervous, because you know, I'm not an expert in psychology and sociology. So, and but people always want to talk to me about humans. Certain aspects of things I'm really confident talking about. So what people always ask me, what does bitch say about humans? Well, I think it does have a big message, which is that it shows the role of variation. You know, because as humans, we our society, we're sort of struggling a bit, less so here because you're so enlightened in this country, but with the variation that we have in amongst humans.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think when you see the variation that exists in the animal kingdom and how plastic sex is and how sexuality and sexual identity and sex roles, how plastic they are.
Yeah.
And how they adapt to the environment, and you understand how complex sexual determination is genetically, and how similar males and females are, and how males evolved out of females.
Oh, yeah.
Then, you know, that I would hope what that makes us understand is the point of diversity and all of this diversity that we see in our own species. It's the grit that drives evolution forward. And if we don't have diversity, we cease to exist. We won't be able to evolve, you know.
Yeah.
So So it's all natural. Of course it's all natural. People are always like, oh, is same-sex behavior natural? Yes, of course it's natural. Yeah. You know, it's we see it all over the animal kingdom, and it wouldn't exist. It's variation. No. And we need that variation. We have to be grateful for that variation, because we don't know what's around the corner, you know, that we will have to adapt to, you know, in the future. So I think that I think the big message for humans is not to say that males are like this and females are like that. It's really that everything is plastic, and that all variation is normal.
Yeah. But no, that's really nice that you are going to write about masculinity. And I really agree that it's, I think it really wouldn't be nice to be a white man. Well, in fact, at some point, of course, it would be, because you're really lucky and you have everything. But it's, you get all the shit and you cannot really defend yourself.
Yeah, I think it's hard at the moment. I've got male friends of mine that, you know, are just finding things really difficult, you know. Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's such sort of chaos in society, isn't there? In one sense, we're striding forward, and in another sense, we're taking two steps back. But I just think that because we always look to the animal kingdom for a reflection of ourselves, the least we can do is understand the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
Truthfully.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
There is a new generation now that thinks much less non-binary. In my opinion, that is one of the areas where a lot of progress is taking place. Do you also have the feeling that feminism is progressing since, let's say, the 70s?
Yes, I think it is, because, you know, I see that in many institutions now, what's being taught is changing, you know. And so, I write in the book about this very famous experiment with fruit flies that happened in the 1940s, which was this sort of English geneticist called Angus Bateman, and he did this experiment using fruit flies that he was seeking to find evidence, empirical evidence, scientific evidence, to support Darwin's stereotypes of masculinity and femininity, and in particular that males were gained more from mating with multiple females, and females had nothing to gain from mating with multiple males. So he did this experiment, and hey presto, he got the results that he needed to support Darwin's claims.
Yeah.
And that experiment now is taught as gospel. It's like it's taught as, you know, there's a very famous graph from that experiment that's in every single textbook.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Bateman's paradigm, is this graph. And Patricia Goarty, who's this amazing feminist scientist now in her 80s, has spent the last 20 years pulling apart Bateman's experiment and repeating it, and unable to get his results, and actually finding examples of a statistical nonsense, just like she says. I interviewed her actually, and I said to her, could you describe Bateman's experiment in one word? And she went, clusterfuck. Which is from an 80-year-old American. Do you know what I mean? She's like,
it's in the book, right? Because she's this one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, she said travesty, really nice. Actually. She's just fantastic. Yeah. And she's done all this work to kind of tear down these stereotypes. And so as a result of her work, in some places now, this universal law is treated as it's not a universal law, that there are flaws in it, right? It's not a universal, right? It's just a theory that applies to some creatures but not others. But in other places, like Oxford University, where I was taught, you know, when I spoke to their evolutionary biology department, they said they don't teach Patty's papers because they're ideologically driven.
Oh, really?
Because she's an open feminist.
Yeah.
And so therefore it discredits her science.
Yeah.
Which is rubbish, because we're all ideologically driven. There is
a day the same about Bateman.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what scientist doesn't have an ideology?
Yeah.
You know, I'm biased. I know I am. We all know. We have to just be aware of our biases.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And actually what Patty always does, because she's such a good scientist. I mean, ideology is only a problem if it biases your science. You can be ideological and still do good science.
Yeah.
If you're aware of your biases, and then you keep them in check, right?
Yeah.
And so, which is what she does. She always she told me she always chooses to write papers with people who disagree with her.
Ah, okay.
Which is really smart.
Yeah, that's really smart.
You know, so she's open about it.
Yeah.
Right? So the idea that she's discredited for being a feminist is just really foolish, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so when you ask me about has feminism made progress,
yeah,
you know, depends where you are. I think probably here you probably teach a more enlightened form of evolutionary biology, but, you know, it varies from one institution to another, I think. Yeah. But there's this brilliant quote, and I can't remember who said it, but I really like it. It's science advances one death at a time. So, you know, the thing is the sort of, I think that sort of old generation who were clinging on to these ideas from the 1970s and 1980s, which is when feminism started to impact and make a change, they're the last guard of, you know, being the heads of institutions and then keeping those institutions in the same sort of stereotype political, you know, place. So I think that in the next 20 years, we'll see a lot of change. And I think this, as I said, this young generation coming up, they just see gender differently, you know. So I think that and people are able to be open about their sexuality and their gender identity now, and ask questions that are interesting to them from their perspective, and interrogate animal societies with a different viewpoint. And so I think, you know, we'll have some really amazing discoveries, and things I hope will change in the next 20 years, quite dramatically.
Yeah,
unless everything becomes incredibly conservative and nobody's allowed to speak out.
Yeah, exactly. That it's so such a strange cliche that you really want to protect your own truths.
Yeah,
and yeah, that's really strange. And also in your book, you call Darwin your hero.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in a way ironic, or is it? How do you see it? Of course, he was in his time.
Yeah, I mean, he still is a hero of mine. I mean, you know, the theory of evolution by natural selection is you know, one of the greatest theories, scientific theories there is. And, you know, it's the grandfather of evolution. That's my passion. That's my religion, you know. So, you know, he is still a hero of mine. And he was an incredibly meticulous and cautious scientist. I mean, he was a brilliant scientist. But that's why I think it's so incredible that he was victim to cultural bias and that he saw the world through these binary Victorian goggles.
Yeah.
And I think you have to realize that if Darwin isn't immune to cultural bias, none of us are. You know, that's the lesson.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, it was shocking to me to read The Descent of Man, which was his follow-up to On the Origin of Species.
Yeah.
And just to see how misogynistic it is. I mean, and racist as well, frankly. Mm. I mean, it's not just misogynistic, it's really racist. I mean, he considers, you know, he talks openly about white superiority and of masculine superiority.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually says at one stage, man has become superior to woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says equally damning things of people from other cultures with dark skin. So that's very regrettable and very shocking, and is definitely a stain on his reputation. But he's still... But he was a product of his time.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Victorian man.
Yeah.
And you have to have some forgiveness for that, you know, in that what could he do? That was just what everybody thought at the time, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that's now a lot of people are being cancelled.
Yes.
But in fact, if you would look at the past and at all that, I was reading a book of Schopenhauer the other day. I think in Dutch, well, it translated into English, it's like... Women are no good at all. It was in my, it was between my books. I thought, okay, yeah, just have a look. And it's really amazing how he can just write it down. But then he just doesn't understand anything about women. And he's open about it, but he's also not interested. And he has all these biases. Mm. But then these are the first 20 pages. And then the rest of the book was really interesting. Mm. And I really agreed with the way he looked at things. And so, yeah, I thought that's so weird that, I'm not very, I don't like the cancel culture very much. But if you would cancel people from the past, I don't think there would be a lot of philosophers, scientists who would survive.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, they were just the product of their times, you know. So yeah, it's I wouldn't cancel Darwin. I would just choose to understand that he was a product of his time, and some of his work has been more timeless than other bits.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
So,
yeah. So do you think it is still the same, or is it changing, that the awareness of biases in your field, in biology?
I think it's definitely, it's changing, but that, as I said, I mean, that's current. I mean, I got an email last week from a student. Yes, okay. It's current.
Yeah.
So last week I got an email from a student at Oxford University saying, please come and lecture. I'm inviting you to, from the students inviting you to come and speak.
Okay.
Because it's really, we really need you here.
Yeah. And you will?
Yes. Yeah, of course I will. Yeah. Nice. But at Cambridge, where Darwin was at university, they've already, the institution invited me to speak already.
Yeah.
They were very enlightened. They asked me to be part of the Darwin Festival
because
they recognise that it's part of the debate and that they see how Darwin's, you know, so that's what I mean. Science progresses one death at a time, because it's all about institutions and then who's running the institutions and so how progressive they are. And so it's like this. We are in this period of flux with some places that are enlightened and others that are still stuck in the Victorian era. I mean, it's really mad. But it's definitely a live situation that we're in at the moment, that there's change happening fast in some places, slow in others, and going backwards in others still, you know.
So, but there is a lot changing in the field.
There is changing in the field. The thing is that bias lurks in language, in fact, is something that you would appreciate, I'm sure, with your language skills. But, you know, inside, there was a survey that was done looking at bias, this particular bias of thinking of females as being fundamentally passive and males as being fundamentally active.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea dates all the way back to Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote about it.
Yeah.
And it comes from the fact that eggs are sedentary and sperm are mobile. So females are passive and eggs. I suppose there's a certain logic to it. Do you know what I mean? But it's,
I didn't see it.
It's mad, right?
Yeah.
But that idea that females are fundamentally passive and males are the active drivers of evolutionary change.
Yeah.
That is, a lot of people still believe that.
Yeah.
And along with Bateman's paradigm and the fruit fly experiment.
Yeah.
Those two things that are actually very big.
Yeah.
They seem small, but they're actually very big.
Yeah.
Are still debated quite heavily.
Yeah.
And some people really cling to them.
Yeah.
And the thing about that bias, even though you might interview somebody and they might say, "Oh, no, of course females are can be competitive and promiscuous and whatever." But the language that's used in scientific papers, the language that they use, often just implicitly suggests passivity in females.
Yeah.
And active words.
Yeah.
Males act, females react.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So it's actually really ingrained.
Like a paradigma, or how do you say that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's threaded into the it's woven into the paradigm in the language that we use, basically. And so there was a survey that was done of scientific papers that found that of current papers, that language of females being passive and males being active is still woven through the papers. And assumptions about males being competitive, whereas females not being competitive, they're so assumed to be part of the fabric of knowledge that they don't even have to be cited. There's no references provided. There is still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. In that way, it's very exciting times, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. I have great hope, you know, because, you know, partly also that this is, you know, I hopefully I'm part of the argument that's moving things forward and inspiring people. I've had some lovely messages. There was this scientist, who young female scientist, who reached out to me, who had done some really interesting work tearing down the stereotype of man the hunter.
Okay.
Which is like sort of like a classic stereotype, you know, the idea that it's only men that go hunting. And she was this really cool American scientist, young. She said that she'd been inspired by reading Bitch to stand up to, because she's a weightlifter, right?
Okay.
And she's a physiologist as well. Yeah. And she'd noticed in the gym that she can lift heavier weights than a lot of the men can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she thought, well, I'm not supposed to be able to lift weights that are heavier than men.
Yeah.
So what's going on there? And then she did a lot of research into how muscles work.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the thing about women is that they're built for endurance, right? So even though men will beat women in most races, when you go over a certain distance, women start winning.
Mm-hmm.
Because their endurance.
Yeah.
That's right. So if you're hunting down big prey, you know, that's an endurance sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to chase an animal until it drops dead. I mean, yeah. If you've ever watched hyenas hunting, it takes a long time, right?
Yeah.
So who are you going to take with you? Someone who's built for endurance.
Yeah.
You know, so she'd written this amazing paper about how challenging this idea of men being the stronger, and it's like, yeah, men may be bigger, but we're the ones who are built for endurance.
Yeah.
So we would have been on the hunts. Like, of course we would have. It's And she told me that she was inspired by reading Bitch.
That's
so I was
really nice.
You know, so that was a real lovely thing to come through. Yeah. So just to feel as part of that argument, moving things forward feels really nice. Yeah,
exactly. So did women were hunting. You're sure about it?
Yeah, yeah. She's written a paper. There's been two or three papers who've come out recently challenging the stereotype.
Awesome. Okay.
She's called Kara Okobek, Ocobek. That I might not have spelt that exactly right, but you know, so there was another paper that came out that did a whole survey of hunter-gatherer societies that are still in existence and looking at the roles of women, and they're not just collecting the tubers, they are also involved in, you know, so these binary stereotypes that we have are all wrapped up with patriarchal dominance. Angela Saini has written a brilliant book about that called Patriarchy, where she looked at the roots of where patriarchy started, because, you know, a lot of people think that a patriarchal system is the primate system, and that, you know, it's natural and normal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as I write about in the book, chimpanzees have a patriarchal society, but bonobos, of course, are matriarchal, and it's a very different, and we're equally closely related to both. So, you know, the fact that males are bigger than females doesn't necessarily mean that males are dominant over females. You know, it's not, you can't make that assumption. So, I think these ideas of, just only men hunted and females didn't, you know, hunter-gatherer societies, they're not as divided.
And it can really change the way you feel about yourself as a woman knowing these things. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, not at all.
This week I was talking to some people, and women and men, and so they said that every person or animal is born as a man, and then you can change into a woman, right? That's like one of the myths, I think. And I said, no, it's not like that. It's the other way around, but I really couldn't explain.
Mm.
So I was going to ask you, maybe you can explain it one time. You do explain it in your book, but maybe if you tell it, then I can remember better, and I can tell others about.
So,
or did I not
just ask me the question again? Yeah, so
there's you have the XX and the XY.
Yeah,
so I think most people believe that all animals maybe are born as a man, or not born as a man, but they are start as a man, and then they can change into a woman. So
people think that.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah,
wow.
They all believe that, all the women, all the men, they were
really.
And my sister is a doctor, so she told me this one time. No, it's not like that. It's the other way around. But
wow, that's so amazing, isn't it? Yeah, no. So basically, I mean, this was a revelation to me, and I didn't know this until researching the book. So
yeah.
I mean, before there was sexual reproduction, animals reproduce asexually.
Yeah.
So they laid eggs. So they were females. So females came first.
Yeah, okay.
Males came along at the dawn of sexual reproduction, when there were two sexes, right? So before there was only one sex, and that sex would have been female because she laid eggs, you know, and then sperm came along later. And there's quite a lot of evidence for that. I write about it in the book. David Cruz did a study on ancient mollusks and found that the oldest receptor is actually estrogen, and the testosterone receptor doesn't come along for many millions of years. So, you know, females were the original sex. So, I mean, which blows apart the Bible story, of course.
Yeah.
Eve was created out of Adam's rib, but of course it would have been the other way around. In the beginning there was female,
yeah,
and then there was male.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to understand that, because I think when you understand that, then it's easier to understand what happens in the womb, because actually the default sex is female. So the fetus, up until sort of 6 or 7 weeks in a human being, it's called neutral.
Yeah, okay.
But it's actually female. It's actually the female pathway. And then the male pathway gets triggered in humans by the presence or absence of the SRY gene. And then the fetus begins to make testes, and then testes make testosterone, and then that influences the masculine pathway. But what's fascinating is that genetic process, because that's what I didn't understand, right? So, and I was taught genetics at university, right?
Yeah.
So, but it was in the 1980s, so it was a long time ago. But, you know, we all know females are XX and males are XY, mostly. So you sort of think, oh, all the genes for being female will be on the X chromosome, and the genes for being male will be on the Y chromosome. But it's nothing like that. It is not that simple at all.
No.
So I spoke to Jenny Graves, who's this amazing Australian geneticist who's been studying sex determination for like the last 40 years. And she's decoded the sex chromosomes of everything from platypus to nematode worms. I mean, she's an encyclopedia of sex. She's incredible. And she was part of the team that found the SRY gene on the human male chromosome, on the Y, which is the male trigger. And she explained it to me, and I actually had to ring her 3 times because I couldn't believe what she told me, because it was just to sort of blew my mind. So it's completely right that your mind was blown. So what happens is, she said, we always thought of these two pathways, the male pathway and the female pathway, as being linear and distinct. Mm-hmm. So they were these two straight pathways, and they would never meet, you know.
Yeah.
And they involve completely different genes. But as it turns out, other than the trigger, which, as I've said, in humans is the presence or absence of the SRY gene, which triggers the male pathway in the fetus.
Yeah.
But if you're a turtle, it'll be temperature that will be the trigger.
Oh, really?
Also, and if you're the platypus, they have 5 X's and 5 Y's and all sorts of different triggers. You know, so the trigger changes. But whatever it is, other than the trigger, which is distinct, the genes that actually make a testes or make an ovary, they're the same 60 genes in males and females. They just play to a different tune, and they are scattered throughout the genome. Mm-hmm. So they're not...
Oh, yeah, you described like an image like they're all... Or
yes.
Somebody.
Yeah, she sent it to me. So she said, so you're thinking these pathways are linear and distinct, and they're these separate pathways.
Yeah.
And she said, I'm going to send you something to illustrate to you what it is. And it was this machine full of cogs and wheels that all interlocked with each other. And she said, basically, these pathways, and it had all these little blue balls going through it, and they get spat out and then change color. And she said, that's what it looks like. And so they're not linear and distinct. These two pathways involve to make a testes or an ovary, involves the same 60 genes, but the pathways are enmeshed. So the whole time, in order to make a testes, you have to suppress making an ovary.
Yeah.
So they're all antagonistic. So it's this mishmash, you know, and of course, this jumbled up mishmash of genes that are working antagonistically and are androgynous genes that are contained by both sexes.
Yeah.
It throws up a lot of variation.
Yeah.
You know, you have one... you have one change, and you end up with something like the common garden mole, which the female has ovotestes. She has, her gonads are part ovarian tissue and part testicular tissue. And although she makes eggs during the breeding season, outside of the breeding season, her testicular tissue swells, is bigger than the ovarian tissue, and pumps out loads of testosterone. Yeah. That extraordinary flexible gonad that she has just requires one mutation in a transcription factor of these 60 or so androgynous genes. Do you see what I mean? So you know, to look at this system from, you know, a kind of sort of mammalian standpoint, you go, well, that's a bit leaky and a bit strange that it would be so prone to throwing up all this variation.
Uh-huh.
You know, we see all the variation that we see around us in our society.
Yeah.
But that variation is the grit that drives evolution forward, because one day we might be a mole and we might be living underground and we might need to have all the testing. Do you know what I mean? So that's the thing, the leaky nature of it, and the fact that it throws up all this variation is the genius of it. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. So
and I think that to me was the biggest revelation, and it really made me understand that, you know, we are, as a species, I think we're obsessed with dichotomies, good or bad, black or white, male or female. We see the world naturally. We look for binary solutions to problems. You know, it's one or the other
things.
You know?
Yeah.
We've been tripped up by that, because actually with men and women and males and females, we spend our time focusing on the differences, but actually we have so many similarities, and maybe focusing on the similarities would lead to more harmonious coexistence, you know, and appreciation of each other to see the commonalities, which are far greater than the differences. Because of our shared heritage, you see.
Exactly. That's so amazing. It's so wild. That's why I really like the title of this, Wild Stories. It's really, if you tell this, I think it's wild.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a shift. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It makes you see the world differently.
Exactly.
Really, really, very really nice. Differently.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you asked me about that, because it's a complicated thing. Yeah. And I go into it in this and I thought, oh, this is so difficult to explain, you know. It's so important to understand it, you know, because it changes your perspective on how you
very much people. Also that men and women have the same hormones.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
I know. I mean, I didn't either. I really had no idea. But yeah, I mean, men can't produce sperm without estrogen.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't get much more so masculine than that, does it?
Yeah. Exactly. I will tell every man.
Yeah.
But so, so you said you wanted to frame the stories more after this book. Did you want to tell stories about animals, and then you found out more and more about this subject? Like you said, I didn't know it when I was going to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like that? And then it became more framed into the female sexuality? Or did you think of the frame before?
I knew, yes, I do understand the question. Okay. Yeah, so I knew that there was I could tell that females had been misunderstood because of sexist bias. I knew that, but I didn't understand the scale of the story. I had no idea that it was so big.
As a
writer, and I'm sure you can appreciate, you always want a big story. You know, you want to, particularly if you're writing a book, you want something that's meaty.
Yeah.
And I thought, this seems like there's a good story here, but I was shocked at how deep it went, and how biased I was, you know, and how I think of myself as a feminist, but actually fundamentally I look at animals and I assume males are dominant. I assume, you know, I just patriarchal stereotypes, they're ingrained in me, and I realized that I really deep down believed them too, you know. So yes, it made me address my own biases, and I was surprised at how insidious it is and how far-reaching it is. Mm-hmm. And how big the story is, really. Yeah,
it's really nice to be able to learn while writing as well.
I would have things where I'd be like, oh my god. So like I was saying, when I spoke to Jenny Graves and she told me, and I rang her three times, I was like, I know, I just want to check that I've got this right, but it's the same 60 genes? It's the same in males and females. Yes, it is. She was so patient with me. Yes, it is. I'm like, but are you sure it's the same? Like, really? But why doesn't everybody know this? Like,
that's also,
I just couldn't understand why one knows this.
Exactly.
Just like, it's so fundamental.
Yeah.
It changes everything.
Yeah.
You know, like, how?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I hope that everyone will know it after your book.
Yes, I hope
so
too.
But I felt the same with this book. I thought everybody should know these things. And
yeah.
Not,
Well,
they will.
Slowly, hopefully.
Yeah, your article will help.
Yeah,
my article, of course. Okay, yeah, well,
but it's nice to be appreciated. Thank you.